From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Coming up, what lessons should the media take away from the coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings a year ago?
But first, officials today are officially confirming what many already think, that Sunday's shootings at two Jewish centers that killed three in Overland Park, Kansas, are hate crimes. FBI agent Michael Kass spoke today at a press conference.
In the last 22 hours, we've learned that the acts that this person committed were the result of beliefs that he had, and that he was trying to hurt somebody based on their ethnicity, race, religion. There's a whole number of categories under a hate crime.
A 14-year-old who was auditioning for a singing competition and his grandfather were killed. Both are reportedly Methodists. A woman visiting her mother at a nearby Jewish assisted living facility, a Catholic, was also killed. But the shooting suspect, Frazier Glenn Cross Jr., who also goes by the aliases of Glenn Miller or Frazier Glenn Miller, is a known anti-Semite. KMBC, a CNN affiliate, captured video of Cross being taken away by police and shouting, "Heil Hitler." Listen closely. You can hear it on this brief clip. Mark Potok is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. They study hate crimes. And Mark, today the FBI said they were aware of the alleged shooter. They weren't monitoring him closely. But do I hear correctly that you knew as soon as you heard this story that it might be him?
Well, as soon as a suspect was named, they gave this name Frazier Glenn Cross. We knew Frazier Glenn Miller. But we very quickly remembered that Miller had in fact been using the Cross name online in a number of different postings.
Well, let's tell us a
little
bit.
In the next hour or so, we were able to get his date of birth, the suspect's date of birth, and confirm that indeed it was him.
And he has a long resume with you. He was a Green Beret who started in the National States Rights Party, then founded and ran Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, sort of an offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan, more of a paramilitary. And your group actually sued him.
We sued him. He agreed to disband his first group, the Carolina Knights. He then reformed another group, White Patriot Party, which was quite separate. Ultimately, we were able to get a criminal contempt citation for his breaking the agreement with us to cease his paramilitary activities and so on. At that point, he went on the lam. He became a fugitive. When he was discovered less than a year later in Missouri by the FBI, they found him in a trailer filled with C4 plastic explosive, thousands of rounds of ammunition, automatic weapons, hand grenades, and a whole lot of cash as well. He was at that time, it turns out, plotting, among other things, to assassinate the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Morris Dees.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he went to prison over all of that.
3 years in federal prison on weapons charges and that charge of plotting the assassination of the founder of your group. But he also ran for office. He's been a guest on Howard Stern. He has a website. What has he been doing in recent years? It seems impossible that somebody with that resume would still be floating around. But, of course, if he hadn't done any act, he would be.
Well, in fact, he probably would have gone to prison for a long time in the late 80s, except that he cut a deal with the federal government to testify against other white supremacists in a famous trial. So for the 90s, he was pretty much persona non grata in the movement, but he's been, over the last 10 or 15 years, working his way back in. He wrote an autobiography about being a kind of oppressed white man. He published a newspaper called The Aryan Alternative and has kind of, as I say, worked his way back into the graces of the movement. So he's been active, but it's been all on a propaganda level, certainly as far as we know.
Well, so now the shooting, Mark Potok, at this two Jewish centers in Overland Park, Kansas, outside Kansas City. All three of the victims were Christian. A lot of people are seeing that as ironic that this man obviously lives in a world where he thinks that these community group centers would be segregated. They are not. He was reportedly asking people if they were Jewish. As he shot. But first of all, how important is this that officials have decided this is a hate crime?
Well, I think it was completely obvious, as you suggested in your intro.
What does it mean legally?
Well, legally, it may not really amount to a hill of beans. And I say that because he is up on charges that could bring him the death penalty in the state. The federal government is apparently considering federal hate crime charges as well. But there's nothing in the federal hate crime law that brings the death penalty. So it may be a matter of simply wanting to show the world that this is a hate crime and have that play out in court. if, in fact, the federal government really does go ahead with these charges.
But briefly, Mark, what does the event mean to you? We're seeing that anti-Semitic hate crimes are actually down. Is this a last gasp? What does it say to you?
Well, I wouldn't say it exactly that way. I mean, what this really tells us, it's a reminder that there is an entire universe, a kind of underworld of people like Fraser Glenn Miller. There are over 2,000 groups in the radical right that operate today in the United States. Certainly most of the people in those groups are not going to go shoot up a Jewish community center, but this is a movement that produces a lot of people. We only need to think back to the shooting of the Holocaust Museum in 2009, the shooting up of the Sikh temple near Milwaukee in 2012, and so on. Another case around the same time.
It is rare but not unheard of. Mark Potok, Southern Poverty Law Center. As always, Mark, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, tomorrow will mark 1 year since two pressure cooker bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Three people were killed. More than 200 were injured. Investigators say the bombings were carried out by two brothers, Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev. The older brother, Tamerlan, died after a gun battle with police. 20-year-old Jahar Tsarnaev faces a federal murder trial with the possibility of the death penalty. Now, a lot of the details are clear now that the dust has settled, but on the day the bombings happened and in the days that followed, there was a lot of confusion. Here is then Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis facing a series of questions from reporters.
I heard the tweet with two people dead, right, the Boston Police Department.
There are fatalities. I won't get into the details on that.
Is that tweet correct with two people dead?
I said I wouldn't get into the details on that. There are people that have expired as a result of this incident.
Were the devices in the trash can or mailbox?
We don't know.
Commissioner, what about reports that there are police guarding victims at Mass General?
There are police that have been dispatched to all of the hospitals. That's part of our investigative protocol to secure the area and also to make sure that we get every witness statement that we can possibly get.
But
all that stuff is happening right now. I'm sorry?
But guarding rooms, specific rooms at Mass General?
There's a heavy police presence at all the hospitals, at some of the hotels, and other venues throughout the city. You shouldn't read anything into that.
Well, joining us now to talk about the media coverage of the bombings and what lessons we should learn for future crises are two people who covered the bombings as they happened. Deborah Becker, senior correspondent and host at WBUR in Boston. Deb, welcome.
Thank you.
And Boston Globe reporter and editor Scott Hellman. He's co-author of Long Mile Home. Scott, welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, and let's start with things that went wrong, because there are some things that went wrong in the coverage of the marathon bombings as they were happening. Reporters got things wrong, and I'm thinking specifically of CNN at one point reporting that somebody had been arrested when, in fact, that hadn't happened. CNN was not the only outlet to report that. Let's take a listen here to Tom Melville on our home station, WBUR, talking that day.
There were conflicting reports. We had information, one of our reporters had information from law enforcement sources that an arrest had been made or that someone was in custody. Other organizations, CNN, the Associated Press, had gotten those reports. We're told those reports are incorrect. I spoke to the U.S. Attorney's Office, to the spokesperson for Boston's U.S. Attorney, Carmen Ortiz, Christina Sterling, a few minutes ago. She made very clear. She said, no one in custody. No one arrested. She says she doesn't know how these reports got started.
Scott, how do you know what to trust on a day like that?
I think it's very difficult. I mean, I will add in full disclosure that I think the Globe was one of the news outlets that, you know, had information about that alleged arrest as well. And I know we put it out there briefly. So, I mean, I think everybody in general performed very well in those chaotic days and hours after the bombing. But there were a lot of things that people got wrong. And, you know, it's so difficult because in that situation, people turn to these trusted news sources because they, you know, it was so panicked, that feeling of anxiety, because we didn't know at that point, was there one bomber, two bombers, were there 10? We had no idea the extent of it. And I think that having to sort of be that voice of reason, but also get that information out to people very quickly is so difficult.
We should say that tape, that happened on the Wednesday after the bombing.
Right.
So that was when there was all kinds of speculation about being in arrest. There was 2 days. We didn't know anything. We hadn't heard the name Tsarnaev at that point. We didn't know who was responsible. We didn't know if there were going to be other attacks. So there was a tremendous amount of anxiety. And I was actually at the Westin Hotel that day. And so the officials there were supposed to hold a press conference, but kept pushing it back. Hmm. And they said, we're having a press conference at 1. Nope, it's going to be at 2. Nope, it's going to be at 2:30. Nope. And they just kept pushing it back. And there were planes surrounding the federal courthouse. There were boats coming in. Everybody thought that there was an arrest and someone was going to be caught, brought into the federal courthouse and be charged with the bombing. So it was just wild speculation. I think the big lesson from that is, you know, watch how fear can sort of fuel all of these things and anxiety. And there was a little snippet of a report here and a little snippet of a report there. And you can't necessarily put those threads together and make a narrative.
Well, the editorial processes kind of go away when you're dealing with a crisis situation. You don't have the same level of checks and balances that you do when you're reporting a story on a normal day. And I wonder whether something like this tells us there should be more of a plan for crisis reporting than there is at newsrooms all across the country.
And I think there is more awareness about this than there is in years past, in part because some of the disastrous election nights that we have had. I think, you know, you've seen this tremendous rush. Everybody wants to be the first one to say, you know, he won Florida or he didn't win Florida, whatever. Yeah. And so I do think there's a little more consciousness about this. But still, I don't know in some sense if it's totally fixable, because there's always going to be that desire to be first and to be that one that everyone turns to. And then we kind of lionize those news outlets and those reporters who do get it right afterward. And we say, Deb Becker was the first one to report that. You know, so I don't know if it is totally something that can be repaired and you know, completely.
Right. But I do have to say, I just did a story about preparedness and how folks are preparing for this year's marathon. And I'm surprised at these preparedness plans for crises. And we really don't have them, quite honestly. And I think it's a good idea to sort of tell journalists, look, you know, this is a checklist of what might be beneficial. And these are the lessons that we did learn from the marathon bombing of what we should do and how we should verify and, you know, who we should trust.
We're speaking with Deborah Becker, senior correspondent and host at WBUR in Boston, and Scott Hellman of the Boston Globe. He's co-author of Long Mile Home. That's a book about the Boston Marathon bombings. And as you listen, let us know what you thought of the coverage, newspapers, radio, online, on TV. You can go to hereandnow.org or you can send us a tweet at Here and Now. This is Here and Now. This is Here and Now, and we're talking about how the media covered the Boston Marathon bombings with Deborah Becker, senior correspondent and host at WBUR in Boston, and the Boston Globe's Scott Hellman. He's co-author of Long Mile Home. And one of the big concerns that came up that week a year ago was that the wrong people were being suspected. There was this kid at Brown University who'd been missing, and some people thought he was responsible. The New York Post printed this cover of bag men, and they had two people who were not involved, but then everyone was looking for them. And let's listen here to CNN's John King speaking on the Wednesday after the bombings, 2 days after, talking about what he thought was going on.
I was told that they have a breakthrough in identification of a suspect. I'm told I want to be very careful about this because people get very sensitive when you say these things. I was told by one of these sources who was a law enforcement official that this was a dark-skinned male. The official used some other words. I'm not going to repeat them until we get more information.
Deb, as you were on the air live, did you ever face a moment when you had some information like that maybe about who this could be that was involved, and you decided to talk about it or not to talk about it?
We had so much information, volumes of information. And as you know, Jeremy, the producers behind the glass, not in front of the microphone, are really crucial in a situation like this. And I think when we were looking on Twitter and looking on the AP and you had a bunch of sources in front of you and people were running in and bringing in pieces of paper to you as you were doing live coverage, you had to be really careful. You were the final checkpoint of what was going to go through. And a lot of times I would hold something up to a producer and wave it and say, what is this? You know, where did we get this from? And people would talk in your ear and say, you know, this is from. And you had to make a quick decision. And there were many times like that when information came in. You know, my rule is try to get it verified at least three times before you even mention it, because you don't want to increase anxiety in a situation like that.
Scott Hellman, there was also the question, even among officials, about whether it would be a problem when they finally did come out and say, this is who we're looking for, because if that person then knows that they're being hunted by the police, they may flee or they may do something bad.
Sure, and that was a big part of the behind-the-scenes debate that happened between the FBI and the police, the Boston police, in terms of do we want to put these photos out there or not. Mm. Interestingly, I mean, one of the things that I think really forced their hand was all this speculation by some in the media, some online, on places like Reddit. Part of the reason that they felt they had to go out there was to put a stop to all this and say, don't pay attention to anything else. These are the two guys we want. These are the two guys we need to find. Nobody else.
Did anyone ever ask you not to report something?
No. I may not have been part of the conversation, but not during my coverage, no.
Now, your coverage, which was done locally in Boston on WBUR, eventually was picked up and aired on public radio stations across the country. And I wonder, when you found out that that was happening, that your coverage was being heard in New York and Los Angeles and all over live as it was happening, did it change in any way the way that you reported what was going on when it went from being something that was only being heard by people who were directly affected or were right in the immediate area to something that was being heard by people all across the country?
Big gulp, that's for sure. but no, I think in all seriousness, for the most part, I think what was guiding our coverage at that point was what's going on. We have a responsibility to tell people, and obviously we have a responsibility first to tell people here who were directly affected. It was get the message out, tell people what's happening, and try not to instill fear in people as best you can.
Well, let's take a listen here to you and Bob Oakes, the Morning Edition host here at WBUR, doing some live coverage.
Authorities say at this point they do not know who is responsible or what exactly happened. Boston police are looking for information regarding the explosions today at the Boston Marathon finish line. And Bob, as you said, it's 4 hours later, and that's a very limited amount of information.
It is a very limited amount of information. But, you know, if you think back to 12 years ago, 9/11/2001, we were in this room essentially reporting on the same kind of event, and the chaos in Boston today following the explosions this afternoon is a huge reminder of what happened in the city that day. Multiple
Deb Becker, tell me about your thoughts as you listen back to that.
I hadn't heard that in a year, right? Mm-hmm. I think you can hear sort of all of the uncertainty going on, and we really didn't know. And I do think that our overarching message really was to try to tell people information, the most official information that we could from officials there, from reporters at the scene, and everything else. But I think what was incredibly different about doing the marathon bombing, yes, we had done 9/11, and we've done a lot of live coverage, whether it's elections or storms or fires right. or all kinds of disasters. But this one, this was personal. We knew people there. We knew runners. We knew the officials. We've been covering them for years. And our families may have been at the finish line. My daughter was going to the finish line that day, as far as I knew. And in all the midst of this, I didn't know where she was because, of course, cell phones were down and things. She was fine. But I think that added to the anxiety of covering this because this was, you know, Marathon Day is a celebration, and it was a very different story to cover.
Scott Hillman?
Yeah, I'm struck to hear you talk about your stuff from that day, Deb, because it occurs to me that, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, in some ways, newspapers and other kind of print media have had to catch up, I think, with these outlets that have done live coverage for years. You know, and now people expect us to put up stuff on Twitter and on BostonGlobe.com and everywhere else. I think that's a training that I think we've had to kind of undergo, and lots of other print outlets too, because in some ways it's the same filter or lack thereof
right.
that we're facing that you guys have faced for years.
But what about that comparison to 9/11? I was in New York City when I heard that. I heard you on the air in New York City when Bob made that comparison to 9/11. And I wonder, a year later, does that feel like a stretch? Does it feel like on that day, that's what it felt like?
I think it absolutely felt like that day, because there was just so much uncertainty. As we heard in that clip, we didn't have much official information. We didn't know. At the time, there was also some sort of a fire at the JFK Library.
Right.
We didn't know where these people were. We didn't know if there was going to be another attack. So it absolutely felt like 9/11.
I want to finally ask both of you about your sense of responsibility as journalists, and that was a holiday, by the way. It was Marathon Monday. It was Patriots Day, and most people weren't working in this city. But at what point do you have that feeling of, I'm a journalist, I am a very important part of dealing with a crisis like this and getting information out there, Scott?
I think this is clearly one of those all-hands-on-deck situations. 9/11, of course, was another one, and they come few and far between. Where
Katrina was another one,
Katrina,
too.
Katrina, yeah. Right, if you're in a certain kind of news organization. You know, everyone's operating on multiple levels, but I think certainly volunteering to do whatever is necessary to help.
Deb Becker?
Well, I think that day I was working. I was covering the marathon, and we had a skeleton crew in the newsroom because it was a holiday, and that was very difficult. And once we realized that something was wrong, we just started calling people, saying, you know, get here and help us. And then, of course, throughout the week, every day was another long day of covering things and figuring out what to do, and the president coming, and then the shelter-in-place order and all of that. So I think it is a situation where everybody says, you know, we do have a role here to inform people. And I think that in this particular case, a good lesson was you don't have to be first. You really don't. And watch the urge to try to be first, because what's more important is that you try to keep people informed and aware as best you can without that sort of get it first mentality.
Deborah Becker, senior correspondent and host at WBUR in Boston, and Scott Hellman of the Boston Globe. He's co-author of Long Mile Home. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And with the start of the week, many on Wall Street are watching to see if last week's big sell-off of tech stocks will continue. Thursday saw the largest one-day sell-off in biotech stocks in over 2 years. The Nasdaq fell 3%. On Friday, it fell again, part of a larger three-week slump in tech stocks. Are we in another tech bubble similar to the early 2000s? Cardiff Garcia of the Financial Times has been pondering that. Cardiff, welcome.
Hey, Robin.
And so what do you think? Is this another bubble bursting?
So part of this, I guess, has to do with semantics. Where do you draw the line? How do you define a bubble, right? What I can say is that it was probably inevitable that at some point you were going to have this kind of a sell-off. This part of the stock market had been doing better than the rest of the stock market for quite some time. And the question is what triggered it. Nobody actually knows. There's kind of a newsroom joke about how when you can't explain what's happening, you just say that stocks are down based on fears that stocks would go down, mm-hmm. right? In terms of what's happening in tech and biotech, though, I think there are a lot of differences between now and what happened in 2000. There's less reason to be nervous, right? So people who follow the stock market like to look at ratios that compare the stock price to how much money companies are actually making, their profits. And those ratios are really a lot lower now than they used to be. Plus, a lot of these companies have a much bigger market in which to sell their products, just because so many more people are now connected via the internet than were in the year 2000. So I think right now, you know, it's impossible to say whether this will continue or how much worse it will get. I also think that this is fine, that in some sense, this is a healthy development, that it's good for investors to be reminded now and again that parts of the stock market go up and it also goes down. Especially for sort of normal everyday household people who aren't sophisticated Wall Street investors, it's good to be reminded that you shouldn't have too much of your money concentrated in one part of the market.
Well, and it's just so as you say, it might be something of a leveling off, but you also said it might feed on itself. We're reading in your paper, the Financial Times, of how insiders at some internet companies are unloading their personal tech holdings. So could the leveling off become a problem if it inspires more sell-off?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, and the idea here is that executives at some of these companies have been reducing their stake in these companies for some time. And what's interesting about that, though, is that there are some technical reasons for it. As you know, as the stock prices go up or as the valuations of these companies go up, it makes sense for some executives essentially to reduce their own concentration of wealth, right? But at the same time, this is sort of broad enough that it does make you worry that they themselves think that maybe stock prices are a little bit too high. But I would actually emphasize that there's a good story here too, which is that when it's easier for these companies to raise money or when their stock prices go up, it's also easier for them to invest in their own companies, to invest in research and development. And that actually is a big boost to the consumer, to people who use these products and who now see that incumbent companies have new competition. And so there's a lot of examples here. Biotech's an obvious example. If they invest in new R&D, you might have, you know, a miracle drug coming online sometime soon. Or if you look at the tech sector, look at what's happening happening with companies like Box or Dropbox. These are companies that sell online storage. They don't make money, and yet they forced companies like Google to reduce the prices that they charge for the same services. And so I think that something like this is compared to a credit-driven housing bubble, as we had, you know, in 2007, 2008, can actually be a good outcome for society, even if for some individual companies or for some parts of the stock market, it's a little bit more unclear what's going
to
happen.
Well, Cardiff Garcia, again, of the Financial Times, we're going to have to leave it at that with just a few seconds left. We'll have you come back and explain why we opened the paper today and we see all these tech startups raising billions of dollars.
There's still a lot of excitement about the sector.
That's right. Why is that happening if the stocks are plummeting? Cardiff Garcia, the Financial Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Over the last few decades, roads, homes, commercial buildings have cut across the wide open spaces of the West. And that development is having an impact on many of the species that live there, especially the pronghorn antelope, especially in one of the fastest growing areas in the Southwest, Arizona's Prescott Valley. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Laura Morales at KJZZ's Fronteras Desk reports.
Jim McClasland has lived in Prescott Valley for more than five decades, and he's watched it change from his front porch.
You stand here and look. You can see. You have to see this, but there's no buildings. There's no people. There's not all these trees. It was just wide open country.
And thousands of pronghorn antelope were free to roam. Today, the valley is packed with houses and strip malls. When McClasland bought a house, he decided to live on the outskirts of town to enjoy the wildlife.
But at the same time, I took habitat, and I consciously knew that I was doing that, but I also consciously did not put up a fence. This fence that my neighbor has affects movement of wildlife. It just does.
I take a drive with the Arizona Game and Fish Department's Virginia Goldsberry and Zen Makarski. They show me how those fences fragment pronghorn habitat. We drive beyond the fences to where we hope to see antelope. I have my camera ready. We have trouble finding them. It's fawning season, so many females are bedded down, ready to have their babies. But there are also fewer antelope here today. Researchers once estimated 5,000 antelope in this area. Today, there are only about 1,000 in Prescott Valley.
We just drove past a subdivision called Pronghorn Ranch. There's pronghorn everything out here. What's your reaction to that? I mean, it's kind of ironic, huh?
Well, it'll be ironic if it all gets developed and there's no pronghorn out here, but half the streets are named Pronghorn Lane, Road. Some of the subdivisions are Pronghorn Ranch. It was used as a, you know, back, you know, 20 years ago, it was used as advertisement to have people come out here and move and build houses by a lot of the developers to, you know, say, come live at the Pronghorn, and a lot of people moved here for it.
The antelope are unique. They're the fastest animal in North America. They can maintain speeds up to 60 miles per hour, but they're also very high strung. The idea of crossing a road overwhelms them. When Game and Fish has tried to relocate pronghorn, Makarski says a few typically suffer what's called capture myopathy.
For a human, it would be similar to a heart attack in that they just overstress and their heart begins to beat so fast and it stops.
Back in the early 90s, Prescott developers built a subdivision where a large herd of pronghorn lived. Game and Fish tried to relocate some of the animals. A few died in the process. When people found out, they protested. Makarski says Game and Fish backed off, but warned that without relocation, the entire herd would die a slow death.
It took less than a decade for that herd of 129 to go from 129 down to 100, down to 90, down to 50, to the point today where there are zero. There are none left. And it just proves the point that the do-nothing approach doesn't work.
He says the antelope died for several reasons. The animal's primary defenses are their tremendous eyesight and speed. They need wide-open grassland to see a predator coming. When antelope are confined to a small space, inbreeding becomes a problem. This winter, Game and Fish relocated eight antelope from this area. Volunteers in southern Arizona removed almost 4,000 acres of mesquite and modified 50 miles of fences so the reintroduced antelope could crawl under them. Across the state, researchers are also working on rebuilding wildlife corridors over roads and through private land so the animals aren't so confined. In Prescott Valley, McCarskey and Goldsberry drive down a newly paved road when we finally spot a couple pronghorn way off in the distance.
Oh, I see them. Wow.
For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales in Prescott Valley, Arizona.
Well, whether you live in the Southwest or the Northeast or anywhere in this country and you're willing to stay up late tonight and the skies are clear, you could be in for a treat. A rare lunar eclipse known as a blood moon will begin tonight around 2 a.m. Eastern Time, 11 p.m. on the West Coast. Kelly Beatty is senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. He's with us now. Kelly, a blood moon, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's the color that the moon takes when it's in the deepest part of the Earth's shadow. You'd think that it would just disappear during an eclipse, but if you were standing on the moon and looking back toward the Earth, you would see the sun hidden and this brilliant crimson ring around the Earth from the atmosphere. And that red light is leaking through into the shadow, and it colors the moon a dim, murky red, sometimes copper-colored.
So what's the best time to watch?
Well, the eclipse is a very slow-motion event. The whole thing takes about 3.5 hours. But the core, when the moon is really blacked out, will be 78 minutes, centered on the East Coast, 3:46 a.m. That'd be 12:46 a.m. on the West Coast. This is definitely a night owl event.
Yeah, it's not really even staying up late at that point. It's really getting up early. This is the first in a series of 4 total lunar eclipses that are going to take place at regular 6-month intervals. Is that right?
That's right. This is called a lunar tetrad, and it's not often that we get this to happen. The next 4 lunar eclipses, after a dry spell that goes back to 2011, the next 4 will be total. We've got another one coming up in October. That's also going to be an early morning event.
Yeah, I see Neil deGrasse Tyson, who hosts this show Cosmos, tweeted, total eclipses occur every couple of years or so. If anyone calls them rare, ask if they feel that way about the Olympics. Kelly, while we have you here, quickly, there is another space story today. The Field Museum in Chicago is sending microbes from Sue the T-Rex up to the International Space Station. Blast off set for this afternoon. What are they hoping to learn about?
I think they're going to learn how much public relations they can get by having microbes that are on a dinosaur. There have been a lot of microbes sent into space to see what the effect of radiation is on them. This isn't even the first time that dinosaur fossils or pieces have been sent into space. So I think it's an attempt to see how these microbes behave. They think that they might have come with this dinosaur long ago. So an old microbe, new microbe might have different reaction to the space environment.
Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Are you going to be up at 3:46?
I'm going to take a peek.
Thanks
sure.
So much for coming in, as always.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
This is Here and Now. Have you ever been in a conversation with someone and you just could not come up with anything to say? Yes, of course, we all have, whether it's at the grocery store with the cashier or the person sitting next to you on the bus, plane, or train. So what are you supposed to talk about with these people? Our next two guests may be able to help. Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker are the authors of the new book, What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss. They're with us from KQED in San Francisco. Guys, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, what do you think we should talk about?
I object to your premise, Jeremy. What do
Why?
We get to talk about?
Okay. What do we get
Rob
talk
and
about?
I realized too often we go into conversations with sort of a survival mindset. And we believe that if you can quell that inner panic enough to actually tap into your curiosity, there's always a million things to talk about in any situation.
I'm curious what you had for breakfast, Jeremy.
I had eggs, actually, this morning, which is unusual. Usually I have oatmeal, but today I had eggs.
Why did you make an exception today?
Because I didn't have any oatmeal, and so I had to go with the eggs.
Eggs and oatmeal is the classic choice. I had eggs as well, but it's a dilemma, isn't it? So many breakfast choices, and we could talk at length about this.
Or we couldn't. Let me ask you this. When you were writing this, and as I was reading this, I'm thinking to myself, I don't have a problem coming up with things to talk about, probably because I talk for a living, but I know that a lot of people do. And you use the words inner panic. Is this for people who are scared to converse?
It's for those people, but it's also for people that are doing really quite well, which is most of us. I mean, most of us can hold our own and carry a conversation, but there's about 10 or 11% of the time, according to our studies, where we want to go further, where we're getting stuck, or we wish we would have connected with somebody on the train or at a party, and we just didn't. So this is a book for fluent conversationalists who want to take it to the next level.
Okay, let's bring up some of the examples that you have in the book. Things you could talk about when it comes to the weather. You could start a conversation by offering to show your feet if you lost toes to frostbite instead of just asking people, you know, what's the weather like outside?
Or you could start a step back if the toes thing is too dramatic. But, you know, weather is the classic, like, conversational cliche, beautiful day. Beautiful day, and we call it mirroring. We repeat the other person's observation, and we get stuck in a dead end conversationally. So start with weather. That's fine. Small talk's okay. Boy, it's warm out. And then transition to something that asks for a story. So what's the worst sunburn you've ever had? Everybody's got some experience about an extreme weather condition. And now you've opened up the conversation to story.
I think a lot of people are sort of afraid of small talk. They're afraid, this isn't really what I care about. And Rob and I feel the same way. What do we care about? We care about each other's deepest, darkest secrets, of course. But you can't start there. You can't start at a gallop. So you need a gentle on-ramp, and that's what a weather conversation can do.
You have a section with a lot of times that you might need to talk to somebody or want to talk to somebody, what to talk about with the plumber, what to talk about with your doctor, what to talk about with the meter maid, the bank teller, the taxi driver. Do you want to be talking to all these people? Can't you just sometimes live your life and keep quiet?
No. To answer your question, no, you don't want to live your life and keep quiet.
Okay.
You do want to push yourself beyond your comfort zone and listen to these stories, because not only are they fun and interesting and help you pass the time when you're standing there in line at the bank, but they wake something up in you when they go well. And, you know, that gets to another thing we talk about, which is, you know, when our conversations are just sort of mediocre, often it's because we're sort of bored with ourselves. And if you can sort of wake up the part of you that is switched on, then you'll be about 64% happier.
Think about all the amazing stories that are just under the surface all around you at any time. The taxi driver, the grocery checker, the plumber. They've got incredible skills and they've seen amazing stuff, and it's just lying dormant there, ready for you to pour some water on it and let the story shoot sprout up.
Now, don't literally put water on it. That's a metaphor.
Unless it's the plumber, and then
yeah,
that would make perfect sense. Okay, well, let me give you a scenario that we have probably all been in, which is you're on an airplane and you are next to somebody who you don't know, and you've read Chris and Rob's book, and you've decided, okay, I'm going to strike up a conversation with my neighbor on the plane here, which may mean that I'm going to spend the next 5 hours talking to this person. What should you say?
What you should say is, tell me about your shoes or your lack of shoes. You should say whatever comes to mind just by studying the situation and taps into your curiosity. Shoes are not inherently interesting. The story behind shoes can be fascinating. Why did this person do this? Well, who was with them when they bought those shoes? Did they buy them for a special occasion? So pretty soon you're off to the races. But this brings up another question, especially on an airplane. How do you end a conversation?
Yeah.
Either a horrible one or one that's great, but you just are ready to stop talking.
And I think, too, Jeremy, it, part of your question is that five-hour sort of slog that you're imagining. And it's okay. You can stop the conversation after 10 minutes, and everybody will respect each other.
And what you say is this: it's been so nice talking to you. And that's where
our
book actually—
That could be taken like they might think you're being rude, like I'm done with you.
That's right. It's okay to be rude. We believe in being a little bit bold. If you're not running the risk of offending people every now and then, you're not doing it right.
I need to take a nap now is another option.
Excuse me while I put my headphones in. I won't be able to hear you anymore, by the way.
You've exhausted me, and I must recharge.
Could you guys act out an airplane scene for me, the two of you?
Sure, yeah. So Chris is going to be a wealthy businessman. He's dressed to the nines. And I'm going to be sort of a world traveler.
Okay. You're in first class, probably.
Dressed, yeah, first class.
Definitely.
I got bumped up. Yeah.
Do you even know where this plane's going? I can't remember.
Yeah, it's going to Bombay. It's going to be my first time there. You must have seen a lot in your travels.
I travel far too much. and it's starting to take a toll on me.
You should know, Jeremy, he's lighting an electronic cigarette now.
I don't think those are allowed on planes anymore.
But they will be.
I guess my question is, what am I doing with these trips? What is the point of them? Fellow traveler, what should I be looking for?
Well, you probably got into your business, which is...
It's rubber.
Rubber importing. out of some sort of deep desire or unrealized dream, you got to connect back to the source, I think. I mean, what do I know? I'm just a kid with a backpack.
How did you get up to first class anyways? What, did you have to sneak through?
Just being nice to people and asking them about themselves.
Okay, so fast forward about 15 minutes into that conversation, and we're fast friends. As the billionaire, I've offered this young man a job, and we ultimately get married.
So, and is that the point of this, that eventually conversing with more people is going to help you in some way in your life, not just keep you entertained?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about all the big moments in life, they involve conversation at some level, whether it's a job interview or a date or that random connection you made with somebody on an airplane that became your best friend. Big human moments involve talking.
And it's not just these sort of quick conversations with strangers where we're struggling for something to start talking about. Often it's conversations we've had going for years with a close friend or a spouse or partner. Too often we find ourselves in a rut and we're talking once again about, you know, our kids or something or the neighbor. And, you know, we sort of long for that wonderful conversation we had 6 years ago that one night at that pizza place. And we want to know, how do we get it back? How do we get out of the rut?
Rob Bedeker and Chris Collin are authors of the new book, What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And if you want some more tips on how to talk to people, you can go to our website. We've got 5 tips for better conversation. It's at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We have the opposite problem. People want us to go away. Shut up. This is Here and Now.